Today's episode is sponsored by John Paul the Great Catholic University at Escondido, California. St. John Paul II had a deep appreciation for the arts, and you may know that he was even an actor and a writer himself. He understood how influential storytelling and art can be on our culture, really having the power to move people's hearts towards God. Inspired by this call, John Paul the Great Catholic University is forming the next generation of creative professionals who will be bringing truth, beauty, and goodness to the entertainment industry. People who enroll can study film production, acting, animation, screenwriting, music design, and even video games. If you want to foster your God-given creative talents within a supportive and faithfully Catholic environment, we encourage you to explore JP Catholic's program and scholarships. JP Catholic is offering our listeners a full application fee waiver, which you'll find at jpcatholic.edu/herald. Applications are still open for this fall, with generous scholarships available. Pursue excellence in your creative craft without sacrificing your values. Visit jpcatholic.edu/herald. Perhaps you're not actually looking for a degree, but instead you want to sharpen your storytelling skills. JP Catholic also offers free online courses, such as a crash course in storytelling. Learn screenwriting from Christians who work in the industry. Whether you're interested in a full degree or free online classes, visit jpcatholic.edu/herald. That's jpcatholic.edu/herald, as in H-E-R-A-L-D. Welcome to Merely Catholic, with me, Gavin Ashenden. Few people are better qualified to talk about euthanasia than Professor David Jones. He began by reading for a degree in natural sciences at Cambridge and followed that with a degree in theology from Oxford. His academic career has been deservedly swift and stellar. He's currently Professor of Bioethics at St Mary's University, Twickenham, and Director of the Anscombe Bioethics Centre in Oxford. He's also Vice Chair of the Ministry of Defence Research Ethics Committee and a member of the Department of Social Justice of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. For some years, the issue of euthanasia has been a serious matter for philosophical and theological debate, but those days are over. It's about to become real. For those of us who've been arguing about it in the public space, it's been clear for some time that the appetite to kill the elderly has begun to match the appetite to kill the pre-born. If a life is not useful, why not kill it? The Catholic insistence that life is a gift and not ours to artificially create or ruthlessly terminate is now all that stands between our society and the prospect of a deeply alarming dystopia in which the state decides when it's acceptable to discard or keep human beings on any grounds it chooses, but with usefulness and expense being at the top of the list for the moment. The problem with the public argument in favour of allowing individuals to ask the state to terminate them when life becomes too uncomfortable is that watertight definitions are very hard to come by, and that the promises of unmovable safeguards have never been kept in the past, and there's really no reason at all to think they'll be kept in the future either. Quite the opposite. What becomes a matter of existential convenience for a well-resourced member of the progressive bourgeoisie can become an unwanted invitation to do away with yourself for the more economically and socially vulnerable, whose claim on diminishing resources is increasingly brought into question. So to discuss these and other issues, Professor David Jones joins me now. David, it's great to have you on, and I absolutely love the tie, which you reminded me, because people will want to know where you get such ties from. Can you tell me its provenance? Because I think this is probably one that's going to be certainly not the most memorable part of our conversation, but it will add a foundation of aesthetic interest for those who are sensitive enough to understand these things.
Yes, it was hand painted by Christina Gascoigne. That's the wife of Bamber Gascoigne, who has a sideline in ties. And I bought it once when I went to the opera and I realized I'd forgotten a bow tie and I had to buy one from the shop, from Glyndebourne, this was. And this was the one I bought. But then I subsequently met her a couple of years later, and I said, did you paint this tie? And she said, yes, I did. So, well, I'm confident that this is actually painted by the lady herself.
I'm sure it's true. This is also memorable because it's the first time I felt disastrously underdressed on this podcast. But that's no good thing, no bad thing. David, thank you so much for coming to have this conversation now. It's obviously very timely with the bill being presented to Parliament. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to talk through this with you, as I'm sure many of our listeners will be. Can I begin by telling you the difficulties I have knowing how to start the conversation? Mm-hmm. So the other day, without making this about me, I was interviewed on LBC by an intelligent presenter, he was very reluctant indeed to consider that the issues we were dealing with might extend beyond what he wanted them to be contained by, which was a relationship between a suffering person who wanted to put an end to their life and their physician who was willing to put an end to their life. All we need is parliamentary approval to get the police off our backs. It's nobody else's business. And in particular, the old trope of we don't want these tired religious clerics coming in, speaking to us from a perspective that's of 1,000 or 2,000 years old. This is a modern day technological problem only, and it's private. So if the legislation will only grant us that privacy, we'd like to get on with it. Get off our backs, please. I you know, quoting Dunn as the most obvious starting point, no man is an island, tried to suggest to him that everything that was done in the public sphere by legislative agreement affected somebody else. There is simply nothing that we do, including paying our taxes, that doesn't have an effect on other people. But he was very loath to accept that this was anything more than a private arrangement between a suffering person and his doctor. And I wonder if we could start by addressing that. And perhaps you could move us to a different context in order maybe to try and persuade people who are listening who are either agnostic about the moral issue or over-persuaded about the need for human autonomy in the face of suffering.
Yes, well, I think if you did think it was just purely a private matter and therefore about, I suppose, choice, then the only limits would be how difficult it would be to find a doctor who would supply your wish and whatever you would wish, irrespective of what was the nature of your problem, or if it was physical or psychological or social, and I don't think anybody is suggesting that, other than possibly Switzerland. All of the suggestions have been that there should be law in this area. I don't think any serious person is saying there shouldn't be law in this area, and the laws should have various checks and balances, safeguards or what are alleged to be safeguards, and so on. And that's because it's a profoundly public thing. I mean, it is related to assisted suicide. Physician-assisted suicide is a form of suicide. It's a socially sanctioned one, but it is still somebody ending their own life. And what we think, I mean, I think the great step forward in understanding suicide in the 19th century with Durkheim was a moving away from thinking of it purely as a private matter, purely as something that I do to myself, and thinking of it in terms of what have we done that you feel you need to do this? What can we do in order to help you not to feel like this? How can we structure society so this is less likely to happen? But these things are, they're profoundly social. I mean, the whole imperative for suicide prevention is profoundly social. The National Health Service is profoundly. I mean, if we want to have a purely privatized health service where you have a certain number of tokens and you can spend them on any doctor to do any procedure, then we would have a very, very different, we'd have something which would look a lot more like America, and you spend a huge amount more money without actually getting better impact on people's health in society. And we understand that in relation to in general to the National Health Service. And this is, I would say, this is even more so, because this is life and death.
I'm absolutely entranced by your having thrown in rather casually the concern that one of the things that gets thrown up sociologically, or perhaps we might talk in terms of group psychology, is the sense of what have we done that this may have happened to you, or that you've taken this particular attitude. Because as we know, whenever somebody kills themselves, one of the most profound responses is a desperate sense of guilt and anxiety on behalf of everyone who knew them, even mm-hmm. remotely. What was there? Is there anything I could have done that would have that might have relieved their mental pain? In what way am I remotely at fault, or have I failed? Because this feels to me like my failure, as much as it must feel like it did feel to their failure as well. Can you? I just want to look briefly under the stone. Can you tell me where this comes from? Why you rose it? I'm also extremely interested in your reference to Durkheim, which I have some interest in. But anyway, first of all, this business about neighbor guilt.
Well, I think yes. So there's a recent book by Jonathan Herring, who's a professor of medical law in Oxford, and he's unusual in a lawyer in that he says he cares about what's important in life, which is not all what a law is, and what law is not often not very well adapted to. So care relationships and parental relationships and law in relation to older people or people who lose capacity and that kind of thing. And he's recently written a book called The Right to be Protected from Committing Suicide. And he said that we start in the wrong place. Wherever we want to go to, we're starting in the wrong place. And the place we should start is, why do people feel that they have no choice other than to end their life? I mean, this is, I think, an irony of thinking about it as choice, and why it's not good to think about it as just another choice. It's typically people who don't feel they have choice, that they feel that they're trapped in, they're in the straits of thinking that the only thing left is to end it all. And so, if we thought of someone who was young and healthy, that it would be terrible for them to feeling like this, and what might we have done? I think the guilt here, I mean, people do feel profoundly guilty individually, but not just the problem, but also the guilt shouldn't be individualized. It's not simply about I should have done this. It's we yeah. should have done this, and it's how do we help create more supportive environments where people are don't feel that they need to do this. And if you look at the reasons that people give for ending their life by physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia, and you look at the reasons that people attempt suicide, there is a great overlap, and often it's to do with, they may also have physical problems, they may also have typically there'll be a health condition and so on, but it's also about feeling hopeless, not feeling that there is anything in the remaining time to live for, feeling a burden. I think feeling a burden there was a wonderful woman, Alison Davis, who was a disability rights campaigner, and for many years she had felt suicidal. And it wasn't a straightforward journey at all. It was a long journey before she sort of came out of that with the support of her friends. But she said, when she was feeling low, she thought her friends would be better off without her. And she said, "This is a trick. This is a trick the mind plays."
Absolutely. And what's so important about this, it seems to me, in the context of what could we do to make this different? By passing legislation that appears to provide people with choice, we change the whole thing from being implicitly permissive to being implicitly prescriptive. In other words, by saying, yes, let's have a law, because should you not want to be amongst us, well, we may not want you to be here either. And so by all means, step out. That's fine by us as well. That there is there's an implicit notion this is something you ought to be able to do. And therefore, if you combine it with the way in which the brain and the mind works in this mm-hmm. dreadful self-accusatory way that depression particularly brings on, because it appears we're talking, it seems, more about mental illness at the moment than we are about palliative care issues at the end of life, which we may get onto. Mm-hmm. But given that it's a feature of depression, that this degree of self-denigration and self-accusation, for society then to change the law becomes an act of collaboration in that self-accusation, which seems to me to be terribly irresponsible, but essentially based, and this is my sort of frustration with my LBC interview, based on a terrible misunderstanding of human nature. Mm-hmm. So if I can just add a postscript to this, one of the things you're arguing, I normally in public debates try and avoid theological issues because it allows people to drive, to make an artificial dichotomy between faith and non-faith, which I think is mm-hmm. wholly inappropriate, really misleading. And so I normally try and say to people, well, it's about philosophy. We're all doing philosophy. We're all trying to establish worldviews, and you happen with your worldview to have taken out FM. You don't have a metaphysical higher bandwidth. That's okay, but just acknowledge that that's what you're doing, rather than criminalize those who do have FM. And meanwhile, but the real problem is about the reading of human nature, a sort of Rousseauish optimism that human beings have got a sort of inner equilibrium, that they can make good choices and bad choices depending on how informed they are. Whereas it seems to me that most of this debate needs to take into account what Christians would describe as the fall, that there's a flaw in human beings, and this flaw expresses itself morally, psychologically, philosophically, relationally, and having any kind of public discussion without a sense of what I would call the flaw seems to me to be a really serious category error.
Yes. So I think one thing is helpful is to relate this, to write the particular issue of a sister dying or assisted suicide or euthanasia, which is treated in a kind of abstract way, with other things that we're much more familiar with, which are much messier. So, for example, in general, the state of care homes and decisions that people have to make about can they cope at home or not, and what kind of support they're given, and the relations that they have with their, well, often children, but also friends and so on, who wish to try to support, but also have limits of what they can do, and we know that it's really messy, and we know that people, all sorts of things are going on, and we also know that there is elder abuse. That there are relationships which are not good relationships, and in care relationships, there are abusive care relationships of various kinds. And we if we weren't thinking about this special topic, then we would remember that, and yet if you add to the mix, not just who gets power of attorney and how much the house is still worth and that kind of thing, but to, well, how are you coping? Can you really cope like this? I have your best interest at heart. and sort of stories people tell themselves. I think it adds a lethal dimension. And it's not, it might have been a science fiction writer, it might have been a philosopher who imagined that we each had a sort of surgery to put in a little button, which any time in our life we could just press and end our life. Mm-hmm. And this means that it's always there, and if this were possible, we wouldn't want to have this kind of surgery without our consent to put it there.
Yeah.
But that's what the bill would do.
Yes.
The bill would affect everyone, to say, now you've got something here. And so you now have a question. It wasn't a question before.
Right.
Now it's a question for everyone. Now you might think that's good or you might think that's bad, but it's not private. It's for everyone.
That's brilliant. And of course, for the moment you introduced that, my mind went back to my own life, and I can well imagine a dozen times or more when, if I'd had such a button, I might have pressed it, because people enter into moments of despair when the situation seems mm-hmm. hopeless. I was brought up with a sort of stoic classical culture, influenced really quite largely by the Romans. And the thing to do is, if you'd lost a battle, well, the dignified thing to do is to step aside, pay the price. It was a matter of pride and dignity, not a matter of escapism and self-pity. Mm-hmm. And so you can't even restrict the ethical issues here to one side of the moral coin or not. They both apply. But just the suggestion that if that had been there, would one not have used it already, makes one realize what enormous pressure its very existence brings to bear on everybody, and how dreadful our judgment is. I would have been entirely wrong to have pressed that button at any of these dozen moments of despair.
And what makes it invidious is then you have this, but you say, oh, of course we don't want it for everyone, because some people might end their lives and that would be a mistake.
Yeah.
So we'll just confine it to certain kinds of people.
Right.
So we'll just have these people and they all will have the button.
Yes.
They will all be eligible. And now, in fact, what we find is that that group of people tends to expand once it's there for various reasons. So it gets bigger. But however much it expands, there are people who are eligible and people who are not. And people who are eligible, now there's an equivocation. Yep. So if you're feeling suicidal, if you've taken an overdose and you're in hospital, then the support services there, the aim is to unequivocally to try to help you to live. But if you did exactly the same thing, but you also had a terminal diagnosis. And in fact, a terminal diagnosis is a very stressful thing to have. So people who have just been diagnosed, they're actually more vulnerable than average to thinking it's all hopeless and so on. And they find themselves in hospital. Then instead of it being unequivocal, it's now, well, did you mean to? Or which track? I mean, and so it sounds like a dystopia, but it's actually true that it has happened that people in Canada have attempted suicide, old-fashioned suicide, and been in A&E and have been asked about would they like medical assistance in dying.
Wow.
Because they were also in a category of being terminally ill, so they would be eligible. Though, in fact, in Canada, a lot of people are eligible. They have very very loose definition of what eligibility is. But nevertheless, the business of suicide prevention among people who would be eligible for having assistance in suicide means that it now takes on a different sort of character. And so I think those are the people in that situation, they're the people who who are being told culturally by the law, by the way it's framed, well, in your case, it might be reasonable.
Yes, yes. This, as you say, underlying all this is the whole way in which the framing of legislation introduces certain unspoken presuppositions about the value of life mm-hmm. and your value in the community. And this seems to me to be entirely overlooked by the people who are fixated on the exercise of autonomy and free choice. It's almost as if that single issue, I must be able to choose my outcome, clouds any sense of the more subtle implications that flow from the way in which we live in community together.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Go on. No, please go on.
I was just thinking expectations. I mean, another example in the 19th century in India, and I'm not wanting to apologize for colonialism as a whole. This takes us in very different directions. But there were some things which were good, which were done, even if you think that we shouldn't have been there. And one of them was a wish to try to restrict suti. Which was the practice of a widow, always the widow, throwing herself on the pyre of the husband, and you can imagine that this. I mean, again, grief is a time when people do feel like it's their life is at an end, and it's very difficult to see a way through, but. You can't have the practice without the question, even if, and sometimes the expectation.
Yeah.
And then also for some people, abuse, because this also sometimes led to murder. I mean, for people who certainly didn't want to, but for the sake of that, other people would think it was advantage for them if the person was out of the way. So you can't have a practice. The question of assisted suicide or of euthanasia, these are not individual choices, they're practices. They're social practices which are embedded in society and embedded in healthcare, and they change it for everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and one of that's absolutely right. One of the other things that I think is under discussed or certainly under agreed on is the whole creeping the whole inclusion creep, the way in which safeguards which are supposed to be immovable and you can rely on extend into other categories almost inevitably. I mean, so for Catholics, the most obvious example of this, though it's quite difficult to even talk about it in public, is abortion. Mm-hmm. And to say, well, but in view, are we entitled to say that we've seen the way in which safeguards can be eroded for the sake of public convenience or interest groups or changing philosophy of life and value, and therefore guarantees of legislation that will protect people and be immovable are essentially worthless?
Yeah, well, I think that abortion is an obvious example, but it's certainly not the only one, where what is introduced as an exception becomes a rule,
yeah,
a norm, and a right. So not something, not just to alleviate a special problem which would only be used by a limited number of people and so on. I think the danger of assisted suicide is actually much greater than abortion.
Really?
Because I think that even the most enthusiastic proponent of availability of access to termination of pregnancy does not think that every pregnancy should be terminated. Mm. There is no one, it doesn't make sense to have as a worldview. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think there are people who seriously think that every predictable death should end like this.
And this plays into to this whole, this very new for me at any rate, phenomenon of depopulation. So I mean, it's only recently that the people have begun to talk publicly about the fact that we have a new narrative in terms of numbers. The numbers always were, we're terrified about there being too many people on the planet and the ecological problems of too many people and the financial problems. We appear to be breeding like rabbits, as someone has once publicly said. But in reality, there's a new narrative coming now that from the sociologists, and that is that actually we've reached, if you like, peak population growth. And what we're facing instead now is the failure to keep the numbers up where they are at the moment. And what that will do in particular is to provide an enormous imbalance in terms of old people. And in fact, economically, sociologically, and all the framework of the way in which we run society will be thrown out of balance because there won't be enough young people to support the number of old people. And this is not just about pensions, but it's obviously about medical resources and care. The moment we introduce euthanasia into this mix, it seems to me that we're providing a terrible prescription for the mass culling of the useless in a global depopulation crisis. Is that apocalyptic thinking? Is that taking it a step too far, or do you see there's a link between these two
things? Was it a Japanese academic who proposed this quite recently, that there should be, that people should, that people ought to be encouraged to have euthanasia at a particular age because of this as a demographic problem going forward?
It's no surprise to me that he should do. That seems to me that's exactly the logical next step of the situation that I think I'm describing.
Yes, I think I don't see I think that I don't think that it's per se about overpopulation of the old, as it were, the inverted pyramid. That's the issue per se. I think it will express itself through resource constraints, practical constraints, the way in which what's reasonable or unreasonable is framed. It won't come in one step in that way. It will just be a
it'll be gradual.
It just seems more, you know, are you out, you know, are we outliving our useful? I mean, even the phrase, you know, sort of outliving our usefulness, as though most of us are useful most of the time. I mean, we certainly have ceased to be useful. What it is, you know, people are ends in themselves, and they're not just to be used by other people, and they're not just useful to other people. And how we enjoy one another's company is not simply about use in this way. But I think that the strains, and we see this already, the strains on healthcare and social care are such that the danger is that people will make decisions for the wrong reasons or be encouraged for the wrong reasons. Bernard Williams was a skeptic, but he once said, there are many definitions of being better off dead, but by far the most dubious is that I would be better off if you were dead.
Yeah, that's right. But this is exactly where we need to have a philosophical discussion and say that what Christianity does is to introduce an antidote to utilitarianism. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, we can take a utilitarian view of human beings, and intellectuals have, there are whole disciplines like sociology which are almost designed to talk like that, but that's not how we feel about ourselves, and no, that's not how we live. The way we feel about ourselves and the way we actually live is far more existentially sensitive than what we can do and how useful we may be either to a family or to a community. And so the problem with this utilitarianism, have I outlived my usefulness, is that at one level you may very well feel that's the right question to ask, but at every other level it's the wrong. We there's a profound sense that it's deeply, deeply offensive, and that if we engage in that framework of reference, we have set about a process of dehumanization that makes it very difficult to live and flourish. And so this is the point where Christians have to say to materialists, to pragmatists, your worldview about human beings is entirely wrong. And whether or not you want to take it from the scriptures or some private revelation, at least take it from, if you like, psychology or therapy, where there is the same conviction that human worth is much more about who you are than what you do. But to bolster up the who you are, there is nothing more powerful than a Christian worldview. You've been made in the image of God. Before you were in the womb, I knew you. You matter to me not for what you can produce or what you can do, but because I love you. And so we only Christian theology, it seems to me, has the power to save us from this loveless desert of functionality and chime in with what we actually, you know, what St. Augustine so beautifully said, that the human map is made up of, you've made me for yourself and I'm restless until I know you. And it's this exchange of love. What we don't have in the public debate, it seems to me, is the confidence as Catholics to be able to say, you need the philosophical input, the anthropological input that we're going to put in. It's not enough, in my view, to say, you're forbidden to do this because you don't have control over life and death. You know, our moral law forbids you. I think we need to find some more productive way of saying there's a vacuum or an absence of understanding of human value, which only our tradition can offer you.
Yeah, it is a part of the difficulty that we have is, and the reason I think that we tend to default to thinking about consequences and impact and looking at numbers or that kind of thing is that it's a very deep question. The question of why should I live? Of what life? What is the meaning of being?
Yes,
alive. What is it all about? That's that's what it is faced. I mean, that's why, you know, when Wittgenstein says if suicide is allowed, everything is allowed. If anything is forbidden, then suicide is forbidden.
Yes,
and he had three brothers who separately ended their own lives. He was from a very troubled family. He was struggling with this, something that he thought wasn't just the kind of straightforward question, like, you know, what's the price of oil, or can we afford our mortgage, or what should we do about immigration? This is a question about what the whole thing is about.
Yes.
And in that sense is a religious question. I mean, is a philosophical or an existential question.
Absolutely. I was terrified the other day when I heard Melanie Phillips being interviewed, and she said something that I recognize is it was certainly likely, and she says is right. And that is that the younger generation have developed an inclination and an affection for Nietzsche. The language of Nietzsche, the particularly of power relations, is one that seems to appeal to them in particular. And so if we're going back to, you know, what is this all about, to suddenly find a cultural change taking us over where power relations and above all the celebration of the strongest or against the weakest, if that is emerging at the same time as we're considering changing the law about suicide, it's a very unhappy convergence of philosophical currents, and you know, once again it seems to me that there need to be public conversations not about autonomy, not about the law, but about this absolutely essential question: is what's it all about? What is the value of human existence?
So I think that the attraction of deconstruction, of unmasking, whether it's from Nietzsche or Foucault or whoever it's from, is the thought that there's so much hypocrisy out there, and there's so much that people are living something, saying they're living something out, but actually that's not what's going on. There are other sorts of things going on, and one of the things going on is power relations, and a wish to sort of unmask that. And I think that that's I think that that is fine, so long as there's something underneath the mask, you know. I think that the notion that we should try to pull things down, that we should try to unmask, that we should try to deconstruct, that's fine if we're looking for something which is authentic, which is real, which is true, which is honourable, which is worthy, and we're trying to get behind all of this moral accountancy and political pragmatism, and we're trying to get behind that to something else, then I think that it's reasonable to try to deconstruct. But the problem with not having a positive to go with that negative is that you cut off the branch, is that you then that way just leads to sort of despair, and or leads to attaching very strongly to irrational forms of goods out there. And I think that there is a lack of a confidence of a narrative of a place to find hope at the moment.
I think that's so important, but there is no symmetry here. I think what you're really saying is, though it sounds pompous to say it, is that only Christians can handle Nietzsche. In other words, you can only do the stripping away if, as you say, behind the mask, you have some form of inbuilt, accepted existential validity, which allows you a platform from which you can expose truth and hypocrisy. But without that, then, as you rightly say, you slip into despair. Because, again, the human condition doesn't seem capable of managing power relations on their own. And I think, well, you know, once again, we're back to this this reading of human nature, and I think the great power of Christianity seems to me to be that it's congruent with the gospel. There's something inside us that says, actually, I think I do manage better being loved than being controlled, or even more important, I manage better by loving than controlling. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly that choice. Well, I mean, Melanie Phipps is suggesting we're at one of these moments in cultural history where as we make this choice between love and control, we either retain all the advantages of Christendom or we slip back into a form of dark paganism based on power and ethical relativism. And my fear is that this legislation, which again seems to be produced simply to bolster up people, you know, the bourgeois autonomy, is actually a canary down the coal mine, saying, no, this is how you choose on this is going to affect whether you remain Christian or become pagan.
But I also think that there's a I think that the control and love, I think that that is really at the heart of this. And there is something that this is the whole euthanasia or assisted suicide is about control. But there's also an irony, I think, that people want to have the notion of control, but they don't quite want to take responsibility for it. That's why you have to dress it up in a white coat, and it is very, very noticeable in other countries where you have a choice between either the doctor doing it or people doing it themselves. Overwhelmingly, 97%, 99%, 99.9% of people do not wish to do it themselves. They wish the doctor to do it. So in Belgium, not Belgium, in Canada, in 2022, out of 13,000 assisted deaths, which just on its own should be a something to think about when people are thinking, what do we open the door to if we go down this route? A country half the size of ours. Out of 13,000 assisted deaths, which in theory could either be self-administered or administered by a healthcare professional, less than 7 were self-administered.
Do you know, I'm absolutely blown away by that, because you know it's as one puts oneself in the, you know, on the other side of the argumentative coin. As I say, I mean, I don't think I'm alone in this, but I mean, I've had moments of despair and impossibility where I've seriously thought, for good reasons and bad reasons, this is the time to end it all. And as I put myself in the position, well, okay, if I get a prognosis that I'm going to die of cancer, why not speed it all up, save the suffering, save the resources? It had never occurred to me that I would ask somebody else to push the button. I mean, this is the first time I've ever even thought of it. I'd always assumed it would be me doing it. And then, you know, that would give me a chance, you know, maybe a day, maybe 6 hours, maybe an hour to prepare myself. And then it seems to me absolutely essential that if one's going to take this decision, it should be self-administered. It seems to me wholly immoral to delegate it to somebody else. A form of escapism.
Of countries that have regulations, so Switzerland doesn't really have any regulation, but of countries that have regulation in this area, that is to say, Australia and New Zealand, United States, Canada, Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, Spain, Colombia, and possibly Portugal soon, only the United States has self-administration as a requirement.
No. Good.
Everywhere else, in Australia, all the states in Australia, and it's always, and when you have it, I mean, there's a strange combination in the Netherlands, because doing it yourself, people don't always, it doesn't always go as you might think.
Indeed.
There are 97% or whatever of cases are simply lethal injection, but then there are about 2.5% that are where people take the poison themselves. But then of those, there's between 10% and 15% which are called both mixed. Termination by administration and self-administration. And what it is it lasts too long, so the coup de grace is done by the doctor. Oh. So you have the doctor waiting there with the syringe. Oh. And if the person, you know, isn't dying quickly enough, or they're vomiting, or they're lingering, then this is enough, finish them off. But even with regards to self-administration, it is still, there's still this wish to have it within the protection of the medical profession. It's the medical profession, and to the so it's not, why is the doctor doing that? Because a lot of this, I mean, it isn't necessarily, ending your life isn't necessarily something which is medical, and there are lots of non-medical ways that people end their lives. It's not essentially a medical thing. But making it medical is a way to have an authority figure who is giving you validation, who is saying, yes, this is right, who is giving you the medicine. He's making it into medicine.
This is absolutely huge. I mean, you've really, I don't know. I mean, you've blown my mind away. First of all, I didn't know any of this. I had no idea that these statistics existed, which means I imagine lots of people don't either. They're not, they're not hugely in the public domain. But the implications of this seem to be enormous. I can well imagine that people might say, well, as a matter of, not taking full responsibility, or you know, putting myself in a kind of childlike dependence with an authority structure, I might want to delegate the choice to a professional of some kind. But it seems to me that whilst that's also true, what you're saying goes much, much further than that. And again, it's not just about the utilitarian question of, of can I kill myself effectively, but do I need a real professional to do it? It's that if the legislation is framed in this way, it suggests some complete outsourcing to an authority figure that perhaps replaces God, replaces the psychological inner parent. And the implications of this seem to me to be huge. It's about a dereliction, or it's a dereliction of autonomy, not the affirmation of autonomy. In other words, this is being sold to us by these wealthy, well-resourced bourgeois people who don't want to face suffering as the ultimate choice in the expression of autonomy. But what you're saying is that reality is it's absolutely the opposite. We're surrendering autonomy and saying to some technician, you do it.
Yes, but it is about control.
Yeah.
It is about control. But it is also strange about handing over control. And this is a big and a scary thing. And, you know, I might want to drive my own car, but I don't want to drive a jumbo jet. Something which is big and scary, one wants to have someone in control who is the kind of authority figure who can wield that control, who can wield the control. So I think it is about... It is about trying to have a technical solution to death, almost. It is about trying to control the ultimate our mortality, but in order to do so, we need this authority figure. We need, even if it's only to ask his permission, God. His or her. But it's really the doctor there is there to bring this ultimate mystery of our mortality into human control. And that must be medical control, because it's only the doctor who can do this.
This is absolutely terrifying. I mean, two elements of the conversation have taken place is, you know, one of the things I've always said is this will change the whole relationship with the doctor. You know, until this moment, if a doctor came into the room, you would always know they were going to, at least notionally, do their very best to make you better or to help you. The idea that they can then come in this ambivalent dual role as either therapist or executioner seems to me to be the most destabilizing and terrible terrible responsibility on behalf of the patient. You know, this really does intensify the existential angst. Is this therapy or execution? But the other thing is, of course, that the common narrative is that so many people die painful deaths. This is all about escaping pain.
Yes.
And I was very moved when I saw in some public media a doctor say, look, this is my life's work. And to tell you the truth, very, very few people die painful deaths. And almost palliative care is really quite effective. And it's by far a tiny minority of people who die in pain. And therefore, you're making taking hard cases and making bad law. But if one does say, if one redraws the picture in one's imagination and says, actually, pain is not the overwhelming problem for most people. And then you add to that this desire to pass the existential buck to some form of medicalized technician, say, okay, you do this. It just has the most terrible implications for who we think we are, what we think we're doing here, what our whole relationship with life and death is. And above all, the dreadful distortions that come in when you get rid of God as part of the whole process of self-understanding, because you then have to replace God with something else. And the idea of replacing God with an executioner, medical technician seems to me to be a dystopian step of the worst kind.
I am interested in this question of why people prefer euthanasia. And I do think that even if the legislation which is before Parliament is only for assisted suicide and not euthanasia, I think all of the indications are that expansion tends in that direction.
Of course, yeah.
I wrote a paper once and I quoted Thomas Akempis, who says, "Man proposes and God disposes." Mm. And with with assisted suicide, it's the doctor who proposes and the patient who disposes. And that has its own issues. But with euthanasia, it's the patient who proposes and the doctor who disposes.
Yes.
It's the patient who is man and the doctor who is God.
God, yes, absolutely.
And that's more attractive to people than the other way around. So, because even though we think, we might think that we want to be gods, we don't actually. We much prefer somebody else to be. But I do think that it is about instilling this kind of authority. It is the medicalizing of the authority over life and death is inherent to it. And I think that's why there isn't, even if it could be proposed in a non-medical way through kind of Elon Musk DIY gas chambers or what have you, that's not attractive to people because it doesn't have this consoling safety. Because the doctor is safe.
Yeah, some authority figure who knows how to take care of you is validating the whole thing and making it happen. But see, that's extraordinary. Because I mean, I had always assumed this would end up as a form of rent your own Elon Musk. Sorry, Elon, rent your own Elon Musk form of gas pod, in which you could sort of step in instead of having a shower, you could press a button and bring your life to the end, and they dispose of you. But if what you say is true, then. You know, it seems to be far worse because it's all predicated once again on a vacuum of the idea of the real God, which we then have to fill with something vastly inferior, which even atheists I would have hoped would recognize as an inferior psychological response to looking for a caring authority.
But also it's worse because we also now think that it's the state which must deliver healthcare.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Not every country thinks this, but we think this because of the romance of the health service, National Health Service, and so on. But this means that it's not just the doctor as an authority figure, but it's the doctor also working for
agent of the state,
absolutely. As an agent of the state, and therefore these questions of allocation and these other questions, you know, come in a way they wouldn't in a purely privatized context.
Well, again, this is so interesting, and I'm sorry we don't have more time, but we've tested our listeners' patience already. But this brings in the whole other issue of state versus family or state versus God. And it seems to me that one of the ways of understanding the history of the last 150 years is this profound challenge of the state to God and the desire to replace God, both on the left and on the right. And again, it's the Catholic Church that embodies the integrity of the smaller community and the family, and then the church as a kind of quasi-family, and says, we're not going to surrender ourselves to the state. We're not going to surrender ourselves to the state's view of who we are or to the state's authority about how we should live. We want some form of mutual balance of responsibility between, if you like, the familial and the collective. But all the way through the last 100 years in particular, the state has ambitions to take over completely and to replace the family. And it seems to me that one of the things that's going underneath this, philosophically again, is the state making a power grab over medicine and existential authenticity and saying, actually, we'll decide when you live and when you die and how you live and how you die and whether you should live or should die. And once again, what's been dressed up as a piece of bourgeois autonomy facilitating is actually a mask for something much more sinister in terms of how we understand ourselves between faith and, we're back to faith and power again, the power of the state.
Just ask yourself, what will be the nice criteria for the cost effectiveness of forms of assistance in suicide.
Absolutely. Yes, terrifying. David, thank you so much for giving your time. This has been enormously interesting and opened up aspects of this whole discussion that I hadn't seen before. So thank you for your work, and thank you for your advocacy. And thank you very much for coming on to the Catholic Herald podcast. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you for inviting me.